Hello from David Rutledge on RN. You're in the Philosopher's Zone.
Alles Lebensschwache geht in der Natur unfehlbar zugrunde.
This is the soundtrack to a film from 1937 that the Nazi government decreed would be shown in every cinema in Germany. It promotes the government's eugenics program, and the narrator is saying, all that is non-viable in nature invariably perishes. But we humans have transgressed the law of natural selection in recent decades. Not only have we supported inferior life forms, we have encouraged their propagation. And what you see on the screen are images of people with intellectual and physical disabilities. It's grim stuff, and the kind of thing that we think belongs in the darkest historical corners of the 20th century. Not just in Nazi Germany, but also in the United States, in Canada, Great Britain, France, Japan, and other countries that all implemented policies in the 1920s and 30s of enhancing genetic fitness through the sterilisation of the purportedly unfit. But for some concerned observers, eugenics is making a respectable comeback today, not via state programs of weeding out so-called genetic undesirables, but via reproductive technologies available to anyone with the money to pay for them. Well, we're going to be talking about eugenics today with Rob Wilson, who you might have heard on this program a few weeks back talking about philosophy in schools. Rob is Professor of Philosophy at La Trobe University in Melbourne, and he's a proponent and practitioner of engaged philosophy.
Engaged philosophy is a term that's increasingly becoming a sort of buzz term to use, and so it is a good idea to try and pin down what it means and how it corresponds or doesn't correspond to how philosophers have usually gone about their business. I think there's a stereotype that philosophers sit in solo rooms, locked away with dusty books, talking about long dead people, and they don't have a lot of connection to what else goes on in the world. And there's certainly something to that stereotype. But I think over the last 30 years, roughly the time that I've been in philosophy, from the time I was a graduate student, that has really changed quite a lot. And there's at least a couple of different dimensions to the kind of engagement that philosophers have immersed themselves in. One, I think, is just within universities, philosophers have become much more tightly linked into other sorts of disciplines, but that's still within, largely within universities. In some ways, I think the more radical and exciting development of this idea of engagement is one that gets philosophy outside of the university altogether into the broader community. And that can happen through working with children, as I've done in the Philosophy for Children or Philosophy in the Schools movement, or more generally with, if you like, groups of people who pretty much don't have, you know, they don't come to it through a university education. It's much less elitist. They might be members of some kind of community group. They might be people who have been traditionally sort of, you know, excluded from these kinds of discussions. They might be people who are marginalized in various kinds of ways. And it's exciting, I think, to try and think about how philosophers engage more directly with citizens, other members of the public.
How do philosophers do that? Can you give me an example of a marginalized group that you have engaged philosophically in that way?
Yeah, sure. So one of the groups that there's been some work done with, for example, and I haven't done it directly with myself, but I have colleagues who have done this, people who have been in prison typically for a long time, and we're trying to think about how do you meaningfully integrate people who often have pretty awful past and in some cases have done some pretty awful things. How do you integrate them back into society if you're really serious about rehabilitation of people? What might philosophy contribute? And I think what philosophy can contribute here is it can provide a forum in which people can start to talk about ideas, they can talk about how they think about things, and they can start to do a bit of sort of, I guess it's not too far-fetched to call it self-repair, but in this, what we would call a sort of community of inquiry model, through being responsible to their peers for their ideas, for giving the reasons for what they think, for getting them up to speed with what's going on. So it's not, if you like, a traditional sort of learning model, like you need to learn about these things now that you're going back out into the broad society, but it's a sort of dialogue that's constructed in groups of people. And that comes from a kind of philosophy for children methodology that's been very successful with different kinds of of groups. And I think it's an exciting sort of group. You might also think about people who are refugees in a country or recent immigrants who don't know their way around. And philosophy, I think, can provide a way for people to sort of safely explore ideas, see different sorts of perspectives, accept that things are a bit different from how they think, and give them that space over a period of weeks or months to absorb that through these communities of inquiry.
You mentioned philosophy in schools there, and indeed we heard you talking on this program a few weeks back about philosophy in schools. And it makes me wonder, is there something about a child that makes him or her a different kind of philosopher from an adult?
Well, they would be different in at least two sorts of ways, and people may have their own favorite list of things that make kids different more generally. But with respect to philosophy, I'd say that what kids have got on their side that adults sometimes have to work at is they've got this natural curiosity. So once you create a safe and welcoming place for them to ask their questions, they've got lots and lots and lots of them. Even they seem like a little bit, they're unformed and a bit silly at first. Once they see that they, you know, are taken seriously and they're responsible to their peers and there's a way for the discussion to kind of progress and it gets increasingly interesting, sometimes they have to change their mind. Sometimes they hear something from another child in the discussion that go, oh, hang on, I didn't know that. Or and it's anchored in their own experiences. You get a lot of, if you like, bang for your buck. So the natural curiosity is a big plus for children. It's not that adults are not curious, but sometimes we have to peel off all the layers of inhibition and second guessing about what other people might think to get a philosophical discussion going. I find that certainly at the university level, that's true, and I think in other sorts of adult groups. On the other side, of course, children know less. They have less developed sorts of tools, concepts, knowledge of the world, and so on. But the really cool thing, I think, about the engaged philosophy model that we've put into play in a number of different ways is that it turns out that this kind of active philosophical discussion is a really good way for them to learn a lot more, partly because you're capitalizing on that curiosity and giving them a license to probe a little bit further.
Well, your interest in engaged philosophy has also taken you into the realm of eugenics, the history of eugenics. And this is a subject with a lot of public interest, and it bears on a range of moral philosophical issues, well, all sorts of philosophical issues. But let's start with the moral philosophy. What issues are at play here?
Well, it's certainly true that eugenics has generated a lot of public interest, and there are lots of different philosophical issues that it raises. Just to start with the basics, eugenics was the idea and the associated social movement that tried to improve humanity, often referred to as the human race, over generations. And it did that through looking to the latest scientific and technological means for doing that. So one of the immediate philosophical issues that comes up is, if we think about a project aimed at human improvement, is, well, what counts as human improvement? What would count as the kinds of characteristics that we value in people, the good characteristics, and what kinds of characteristics do we think are bad characteristics? Do we want to have fewer of in future generations? Because what eugenicists tried to do was they tried to promote the good traits and to sort of eliminate or minimize the occurrence of the so-called bad traits. But what makes a good trait or a bad trait? Now, one answer that is pretty immediate, it's not the only answer out there, but it's just an example of one that's been fairly prominent, is that good characteristics or traits are ones that make us happier, they make us healthier, they allow us to thrive, they increase our well-being over time. And bad traits are ones that involve, you know, disease, they involve some sort of dysfunction, they limit our lives in some kind of way. Now, of course, that just pushes the question back a little bit further, because then there's the question about what is it to be healthier? What is it for something to be a disease? What is it for people to flourish or to be dysfunctional? And there can be discussions around those as well. And here I think it's important that we remember the actual history of eugenics in pursuing this discussion further, because historically there were all sorts of traits that were thought to be sort of inherent in people, like poverty, that ran in families, that needed to be sort of stamped out. And they needed to be stamped out, for example, by sterilizing people who were born in poverty. And there were all sorts of characteristics that were thought of as kind of diseases that I think we would have, you know, second thoughts about whether they're really diseases or whether they're heritable in the way in which they were thought to be, and so on. So that there's a certain kind of, I think, healthy skepticism, if you look at the history of eugenics, about simply jumping straight down that track to assume that we know what's healthier, what human flourishing involves, what's really a disease, and so on. So that might give pause for that kind of in some sense, obvious answer to the question of what the good traits are and what the bad traits are. And that's inherently philosophical. I mean, you need to partly draw on science and you need to be informed by the history, but it's, again, questioning some of the things that we might take for granted, the initial answers we might give, think about the consequences of those answers and being informed by the actual history.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, that broad understanding of what constitutes a human trait. I mean, you mentioned poverty, but a predisposition to criminal behaviour, that was another one, wasn't it, seen to be somehow genetically inherited?
Yeah, it was, and even just criminal behaviour itself, and there was supposedly, you know, there were these classic family studies in the late 19th century that followed criminal behaviour through families, and it was held to be the ground for thinking that there must be something like a criminal gene. That research was debunked almost from the time that it was formulated, and there are various, if you like, intrinsic scientific problems with it that I think are well acknowledged. But that idea still that there were these traits, even if we hadn't pinned down the specific gene or gene cluster that's responsible, I think that's still very much with us. And it's something that we need to be wary about. It does get complicated once you soften down the claims from, if you like, straight deterministic sorts of claims, like there's a particular gene, you know, that would be a sequence of DNA on a particular chromosome. I think nobody believes that's true of criminal behavior or even intelligence, something else that was widely thought to be heritable. There might be a different sort of sense, a looser sense in which you've got heritability, but that doesn't justify this kinds of interventions. It doesn't make the interventions like sterilization, for example, even practical ways to achieve the goals that you set out to do, even though that's actually what people did through the 1920s and 1930s at least.
And this is the Philosopher's Zone on RN. This is David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Rob Wilson from La Trobe University in Melbourne. We're talking about eugenics, theories and practices of selective breeding that fell from grace after the abuses of the Nazis came to light following the Second World War. But today, some people fear may have resurfaced in the form of what's sometimes called nugenics, prenatal screening for congenital disabilities and other reproductive technological interventions. And like its earlier incarnation, nugenics carries a host of philosophical and ethical concerns.
In the history of eugenics, I think there's always been a healthy strand of skepticism about some of the more extreme and stronger claims that were made in the name of eugenics within the scientific community, even in the 30s and 40s. So although it had a certain amount of credibility, there was also debate within the sciences about whether the particular groupings of people, you know, for example, even about the reality of races or ethnicities as the basis for these genetic-based sorts of studies were real or robust enough to support the conclusions that people were drawing even back then. But to come more directly to the question that you're asking about nugenics, I think that, again, historically, the way in which people worried about new forms of eugenics or nugenics came about very much through their awareness of the, you know, some potential dangers of the Human Genome Project, which was the project to sequence the 3 billion base pairs in the human genome. And the idea there was that this wasn't just simply a purely scientific endeavor. It was one of the largest big science projects in the history of science. And it ran throughout the 1990s, plus a few years on either side. And it was motivated very much by this idea that by doing that, by having that knowledge, we would be able to eliminate a whole range of diseases, increase lifespans, better human lives, the same kind of ameliorative human improvement project that motivated classic eugenics. And so the American sociologist Troy Duster coined the phrase backdoor to eugenics to capture this serious worry that eugenics could arise not through the front door of state sponsorship and things like sterilization laws, but through the back door of individual decision where people would decide that, oh yeah, this technology is available to me now and it will allow me to avoid having children or reduce the risk of having children with certain sorts of characteristics and maybe more positively choose children that have some of the positive characteristics that I want. Some of this is in the realm of actually what happens, I think, through prenatal screening and some in the realm of you know, the projected fantasy of new and oncoming technologies like CRISPR in gene editing. But they're still very much motivated by the same kinds of concerns that drove the eugenics project. And so I think there's a legitimate worry about the directions that could take and the sorts of safeguards you might need to build into any enterprise like that.
It's fascinating to me because it's, as you say, in some ways, nugenics doesn't throw out these old philosophical or earlier philosophical issues around traditional eugenics, but do you think it adds to those issues a raft of very modern concerns around individual choice and market capitalism? Because there's a sense in which this is a market model. You know, it's your right as a consumer to buy a perfect baby if you want to.
Yeah, it certainly does raise those issues, though, again, in the history of eugenics, that was always a kind of, you know, this, if you like, what's sometimes called positive eugenic program, the idea of selecting the positive features that we want rather than trying to avoid or eliminate the negative characteristics that we don't want. That was always a keen part of the eugenic vision. And obviously, people are much more comfortable in a liberal democracy with the idea that we're promoting choice. Okay, now it's true that with the sort of neo-capitalistic kind of models that have started to dominate, where free markets have seemed to be the solution to all sorts of things, including issues around reproduction and future generations, we've got an extension of those kinds of issues. But again, they were sort of there from earlier on. It's not that I don't see anything new at all. I think there is an increased kind of danger, partly because people, when they're focused on the negative parts of eugenics, they've often focused on what is called negative eugenics. And you know, as I think you said earlier, you know, Nazi eugenics was the most extreme form of that, where you looked actively to eliminate people who were deemed to have these negative characteristics, not just to sort of restrict their reproduction, but to eliminate them per se, for example, through the Holocaust. So there is a difference, and there's a but the shift to focus on positive eugenics and increasing active choice is just really an extension of what was already there.
And really fundamental to what was already there was this problem that you begin with the notion of undesirable types of human traits, but very quickly you slip into the notion that there are undesirable types of human beings. Now, advocates of eugenics will often claim that you can foster human improvement without explicitly devaluing certain types of human lives. Is that possible, do you think?
Well, in some abstract sense, this would seem possible. And if I were, if you like, an old-fashioned philosopher, I'd say that's exactly where the discussion should be focused, on these abstract possibilities. But what I've been troubled by in my own work on eugenics over the last 10 or 15 years is how eager many philosophers are to explore the pathways for acceptable forms of eugenics, often under this name of a liberal eugenics that promotes sort of free choice and market choices. And what's really troubling about this in my mind is that these discussions on some level are very abstract, and they often appeal to abstract moral principles. And I'll give you an example in a minute. But they take place pretty much without any real awareness of anything but a thumbnail sketch of the actual history of eugenics and how things turned out. And if they were more aware of that, I think they'd be much more skeptical, because those kinds of ideals were sort of there again early on. It's how they got implemented and how you bridge from the abstract principles to the actual concrete practices. So to give the example that I was gesturing at, thinking about the work in bioethics by people like the Australian-born philosopher Julian Savulescu, who works out of Oxford and has for some years, who argues for the principle that parents have an obligation to create the best children they can. Now, I think the natural way to hear that principle or to understand it, to interpret it, is to think, well, that's got to be pretty trivial. You know, of course you want to create the best children that you can. But the problem is that once you, if you think that parents have that kind of obligation, how do they discharge it? And how they discharge it in the context of contemporary reproductive technologies is essentially to reflect and to reinforce a devaluation of people with certain kinds of disabilities. And I think Savulescu himself is aware of this. He's one of these philosophers who's very much prepared to sort of, as we say, bite the bullet. So yes, that is one of the consequences. It is worse to have a disability than not to have a disability. You know, you have a child that's closer to perfection if they don't have a disability than if they do have one. So what that actually means, and there's been a lot of reaction within the disability rights community, is that, again, you've got this, what starts off looking like a positive principle that's, you know, saying, well, we should promote these positive traits, is actually also at the same time devaluing not just the traits, but I think the people who have the traits as well, and often their traits that we think of as disabilities. So again, you know, creating the best children also by its nature means eliminating the children that don't measure up to that. It's just a question of, in some sense, where you stop that process. Do you stop it? Do you have technologies to allow you to stop it at the embryonic stage? You still make that selection, that decision between better and worse kinds of people. So I think it's hard to actually much harder to get away from that than people have thought. And the surprise for me is that philosophers haven't been a little more critical of that overall.
And as a counter to this kind of thinking, we have a really interesting phrase that I see has turned up in a paper of yours, conserving disability. What's behind that?
Well, this phrase, conserving disability, is one that I pinched. Borrowed with acknowledgement from the disability studies scholar Rosemary Garland Thompson, who's in the United States. And it's a counter to what she calls eugenic logic, the idea that, of course, just by default, disability should be eliminated wherever it's possible to do that. And this idea of conserving disability gets played out, just to give a concrete example again, in what's sometimes called the neurodiversity movement that's best known in the context of autism, where the idea here is that instead of thinking about autism as some kind of intrinsic mental trait that makes a person defective in some kind of way or worse off, we reconceptualize the whole spectrum of autistic traits that individuals can and actually do show as revealing just a kind of sort of neurodiversity. Not that there aren't differences amongst that diversity as well, but it's not a simple matter of having some trait that you should simply eliminate. And that movement has really grown up, as we've heard, more from people with autism themselves in these autobiographical narratives that are, I think, quite well known now, and realizing that people have their own voices and they value their own lives and so on, instead of being spoken for or spoken about in the third person. And so, you know, it's given people pause to think that having a trait that in the past we might have thought of as automatically a negative trait and maybe going down the path of this eliminativist kind of thinking, it's something we might actually adjust, you know, our social environments, our ways of thinking, our ways of doing things to be more inclusive and embrace the diversity that it brings with it.
Well, Rob, I'll just finish up with a question that really brings us back to this notion of engaged philosophy, and that's that liberal eugenics advocates will often point to the extreme stress that can affect the lives of parents of, for example, profoundly autistic kids. And it's one thing to say, let's reconceptualize autism spectrum disorders so that we can talk about neurodiversity rather than disorders or disability. But for that reconceptualization to result in material changes to those often very difficult lives of parents and carers, you need the sort of community support systems that can only result from government policy and a profound shift in funding priorities from where they appear to be right now. How do you further the kind of engagement necessary to make that happen? Because we're talking about really big social changes here, aren't we?
Yeah, we certainly are. And I think that fundamental to the sorts of changes here have got to be the voices of the people who are most affected. That includes the parents. But I also think it includes people, for example, who fall on the autistic spectrum in that case. Or if you're talking about, take another often discussed case, that of Down syndrome. These are the most important stakeholders. These are the people most deeply affected by decisions that are often made about them and but without them. It goes back to the old disability rights sort of a slogan, nothing about us without us. And I think that really is a fundamental starting point. And on some level, that's recognized. How well it's put into practice as a way forward, I think, is debated in all sorts of contexts, whether you're talking about eugenics and the kinds of traits that are devalued there, or whether you're talking about other sorts of social programs and forms of inclusion. So it's got to start with the people who are most affected there. And I certainly I'm not in a position, it would be arrogant to put yourself in the position to think that you've got the answers here and that all parents, for example, in those positions are going to have the same kinds of views. They often don't. I've been in a lot of parent forums with parents who are parenting around disability, and there is a wide spectrum of views, and often they change. And one of the things I think is important is to recognize that when they come into that decision-making framework that interacts with a policy-making framework on some more general level, they're coming into a framework that's already got a long history of discrimination against people with disabilities. And even just to recognize that, and to not just in the abstract but in concrete kinds of ways, is important. And hearing from people who have that lived experience is a critical part of the way forward here.
We'll leave it there. Rob Wilson, very interesting to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming on The Philosopher's Zone.
Okay, it's great to be here, David, and thanks for having me.
And Rob Wilson is Professor of Philosophy at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Lots of information about Rob's work available online. We are going to put some links on our website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for The Philosopher's Zone on the program menu. And thanks as always this week to producer Diane Dean, sound engineer Tim Jenkins, and executive producer Joe Gelonesi. And I will see you next time. This is David Rutledge. Bye for now.